Hey, y'all know what I think of power metal? Let me tell you right now. Fuck that nerd shit.
Hello, Joe and other toilet consumers. This is Keegan. I just wanted to drop by and say hello. I hope you're all doing well. I myself am a little bit tired, but that's okay. So, as some of you might know, I actually got a new cat. Her name is Mama, but that's just kind of a nickname I gave her. Her full name is Shub-Niggurath, the Black Kitty of the Woods with 1,000 Young, otherwise known as Mama, because also, you know, with the actual epithet of Shub-Niggurath, she also had about 14 kittens from across 4 litters. So yeah, she has been a mama herself, and she loves you all. So I've got to get going now. I'm at work, so I just wanted to drop by and just say hello and tell you all that Mama loves you, because she is a sweetheart. Okay, I will talk to you all some other time. I love you. Goodbye.
You're listening to 66.6 FM. Radio TOVH. The Flush.
Greetings, friends. Welcome to this week's episode of the Toilet of Hell radio show. I'm Joe Thrashenkill, and if this is your first show with us, what we're going to do here is we're going to offer you a metal-related diversion to make your commute go just a little bit better. Sometimes we unpack the history of metal, sometimes we have a few hot takes about the news of the day, but today what we're going to be doing is an interview with an artist we've been covering lately on the toilet. So if this is your 100th episode, thanks for sticking with us. If this is your first one, thanks for joining us. If you like this show, you want to hear more, you can always go to Patreon and type in Toilet of Hell somewhere, I don't know where exactly, and give us a little bit of money, and then you get bonus shows of varying quality, mostly pretty good. You can also rate and review us on iTunes, that helps somehow, I'm sure. And you can tell your friend, hey, listen to Toilet Hall Radio. That's probably the most helpful thing you can do. Help us quit our jobs. That's what we want to do. Anyway, I'm Joe. With me, I got my good buddy, 365 Days of Horror. How's it going, man?
Going pretty good, other than it's still being freaking cold in April.
I got up this morning because the dogs were yelling at me, and I took him for a walk. Wearing the same clothes I was wearing last night, shorts and a t-shirt, and it was 45 degrees outside. That's the weather's all fucked up, man. I don't like it.
Yeah, I think where I am, we only have two seasons now. It's either just winter or it's just summer. Like, fall and spring are like a week each now.
Well, I believe in natural selection, of course, and we've naturally selected that those are the weakest seasons. So, fortunately, we'll never have to deal with them again.
I will fight to the death for fall.
Might be a losing battle, my friend. I think climate change has already come for you. Anyway.
I'll go down clutching fallen leaves and pumpkin spice lattes.
That's a very colorful language. I like that. We should write that into a song. We ought to introduce our guest here. You know, if you follow the Toilet of Hell, you might have seen him writing, or you might have seen his music. With us today, we've got Dr. Jason Kolke, also of the band Neckwind. How's it going, Jason?
It's going pretty well. How are you guys?
Not too shabby. Would you also like to complain about weather in your neck of the woods?
You know, I live in Chicago, so, I mean, it's kind of dumb if you live in Providence, too, but if you live in Chicago, it feels like you are, inviting the horrible weather. So you just kind of accept it, and you harden yourself within, and you just go with it.
That's fair. I mean, they don't call it the Windy City for nothing, am I right? That's because all the wind, right? We could go into like a whole regional pissing match over weather and food stuffs, but maybe instead we should just talk about Your new record. This one's going to be called The Wolves at the Door. Is that correct?
That's right. Wolves at the Door.
So we premiered Scorcher, the opening track from Wolves at the Door on the site. And it's good, man. The sound that you have on that one, granted I haven't been able to hear the rest of the record yet, just that one song, it's good because like you have the hard D-beat stuff, but rather than like, I don't know, chugging in the top five frets, there's like actual melodic guitar lines going on top over it. It's interesting. What can we expect from the rest of the record?
Right. So as you guys know, because Toilet of Hell was one of the first blogs to cover us at all, which I thank you for, we sort of come from this sort of raw, more crusty kind of background. We had a lot of HM2 sounds going on back in the day. The band's been through a lot of changes over the past couple years. We had members sort of coming and going and sort of reworked a lot of our approach. And a big priority was making it so that you could just hear more of the notes that are being played on the guitar. So that it wasn't all just, you know, buzzsaws all the time, which don't get me wrong. I love the buzzsaws. I think it's a great sound. But we just wanted to try to do something where we could kind of articulate those melodic lines a little more and sort of bring out something a little different in the songwriting. Also, it's just a matter of my guitar player, Patrick, who's a longtime collaborator of mine, sort of really taking the reins in terms of the songwriting side of things on this album. So it's very much driven by his particular sensibilities, his, you know, favorite things to do on the guitar. But yeah, I think it's a pretty varied record. I think we hit it on a lot of within sort of the realm of metallic hardcore, sort of a lot of different kinds of takes on that. Sometimes it'll sort of lean more towards the old school death metal, sometimes more towards black metal, sometimes towards sludge. So I'm really happy about that because I'm someone who loves like all of the different types of heavy music and wants to bring out, you know, the things I love from those different genres and subgenres as much as possible.
Yeah, I think that's a good call. I too love just blurs of unintelligible lyrics, notes coming together from an HM2, but it is something different and special when, like, as you mentioned, you can actually hear notes picked out. I mentioned it in the review. I think it reminds me of the band Early Graves, which I feel they had a sound that not anybody else was really doing. It's very similar to what you got going on here, and I dig it, and I'm stoked to hear more. Because you are the vocalist and lyricist, can you give us an idea of kind of some of the themes that you're exploring on this one?
Sure. Of course, you know, I'm pissed about politics, as always. And
but
as,
why?
And like everyone else. So that's sort of the crux of things. You know, and it's not like there weren't things to be mad about during the Obama administration. You know, I wrote about drone warfare and things like that as well. But, you know, now it's worse. So it makes it really easy to find sort of an impetus to put pen to paper when every time you turn on the TV, you're just horrified and disgusted by everything that's happening in the world around you. I tried to sort of vary it a little bit so that it's not, you know, all Trump and all kleptocracy all the time. There's some stuff in there. Scorcher specifically is more about sort of self-destructive patterns of behavior, about addiction, about mental illness, sort of based on, you know, a few experiences that I've seen with people around me. There's a song on there called Coins for the Ferryman, which is my personal favorite song. Which is sort of dedicated to an old bandmate of mine who died, you know, suddenly and horribly. Like he was literally on his honeymoon and caught a horrible disease and died, you know, quite young. And, you know, just, you know, sort of processing the feelings that come out of that. So there's some variation, but definitely the sort of thing it keeps circling back to is, holy shit, this horrible situation we're in. Is there any way out for, you know, America? Is there any way that we find our way to, you know, having some sort of credence in the world again after we have gone this far down this insane rabbit hole.
Well, you know, just in my personal opinion, like, you know, we were kind of raised in a way that, like, the stories that we tell each other, the movies that we've seen, it's the United States is, you know, a scrappy underdog facing off against, I don't know, a handful of religious extremists from the Middle East or a bunch of farmers in Vietnam when it's actually, like, you know, the biggest empire ever. We might not ever get that that credence back, but I don't know if we ever had it to begin with. And do you see a way out and a brighter path after this?
I mean, I think maybe it's definitely open to question whether we ever deserved to be in the position that we were in terms of sort of, you know, in the post-World War II world of being sort of the leading light of everything. Like maybe, yeah, we never deserved that position, and maybe we're just sort of getting our comeuppance at this point. There's definitely some validity to that. I like to think that if people who are generally of goodwill, who generally want better things for the population of the country and for the world at large, can manage to sort of get their shit together, to cooperate on the things where we have common ground, that there could be, you know, improvement in a lot of areas, that, you know, not everything is completely lost. But on the other hand, you know, when I see things like, you know, the path we're going down, especially in terms of the environment, you know, when you've got these kleptocrats in charge just dismantling, you know, what little attempts we had made to address, you know, these world-threatening issues, pulling out the Paris Climate Accords, just dismantling regulations left and right. You know, that's the sort of thing that really makes me feel a little hopeless, because that's stuff that we can't take back. Like, we can kind of go back on a lot of policy issues, but if we just completely wreck the planet that we live on, there's no going back from that.
I was talking with a friend last night. Her home was destroyed by the hurricane in Houston last year. And the projections are that this year is going to be way worse than last year, which I don't know at what point we've got to cut and run on parts of the world that we've already destroyed.
Yeah, I mean, it's terrifying. And I do wonder, you know, is there a point when people start to wake up to this and realize that, hey, all of these scientists and academics who have been telling us for years, hey, what we are doing is wrong and stupid and going to destroy the places where we live. Is there some point where they start to realize that that's not some sort of conspiracy to, I don't know, gain more funding or something, and that that's things that we actually need to be paying attention to? I don't know.
People still think the Earth is flat, so I don't know.
You can't prove it's right. Not.
Yes, we can. We actually can.
Look, it's
there's
it's
that
all...
guy who launched a rocket. Was that last week?
Yeah, in hell his yeah.
Ongoing quest to prove that the Earth is flat. Great. I mean, I guess if it motivates you to do something, that's nice.
I'll give a shout out to the Street Fight Radio guys and that their continued quest to at least argue that the Earth is flat just for the lulz. But I don't know, the new hot shit is hollow Earth theory. I don't know if you guys have heard about that one.
That the Earth is hollow inside.
Yeah.
Possibly filled with mole men or like a milk chocolate center.
I always heard peanut butter, but chocolate is possible as well.
Well, that sort of brings us to the whole comic book thing, actually, as it happens. Jordan, have you read any of Neil Adams's Batman Odyssey by any chance?
I've always been a Marvel reader, so like I never read Batman, but like I've been out of comics ever since they like started becoming like $4 an issue with like 10 pages worth of actual comics, so I'm not really up on what's been going on in the past, like, 10 years.
Okay, gotcha. Anyway, this is the most batshit insane storyline that has ever been done in Batman.
Shit. I feel you.
Yeah, guano. but yeah, it's Neil Adams, who is one of the greatest comic book creators of all time. You know, he's an amazing artist. He did amazing work back in like the late 60s, early 70s on X-Men and Batman, and deserves, you know, a ton of respect for that. The other thing, though, is that – well, there are two things. One, he's not a very good writer, but seems to have some delusions that he has some ability in that area. And two, he believes in Hollow Earth theory. Yes. And is really devoted to promoting it. Like, he creates YouTube videos about it. And in this Batman series, Batman travels into, you know, the Hollow Earth and, you know, has adventures with someone else who's like also Batman. It's insane. And none of it makes any sense. It's all told as Bruce Wayne with his shirt off, with his this gloriously hairy chest, breaking the fourth wall to tell us the story. And it's just the most bizarre, most stretched out story you'll ever read. I highly recommend it just for this peek into, you know, Neil Adams's weird brain. But yeah, just like, it's fascinating because he's so attached to not only Hollow Earth theory, but also the idea that the Earth is actually expanding over time. It's really interesting.
So how does that stack up with like Frank Miller and his like wanting to make Batman fighting terrorist insanity?
Yeah, I mean, so like my feelings on Frank Miller are very complicated, like because like a lot of people who are comics nerds who were, you know, sort of came up in the 80s and 90s, you know, those were some of my favorite comics. Batman Year One, Batman Dark Knight Returns, Daredevil Born Again, and his whole run on the regular Daredevil series. You know, Sin City as well, I thought was amazing at the time. Like, there was no one doing that sort of noir-style stuff until he came along, and then lots of people did it. So he was, you know, a really great and influential creator for a lot of years, and then 9/11 hit, and he just lost it. I don't know. Like, he was always, I think, a little bit conservative in his views, and that comes through in the way he started to pick cities as these kind of cesspools. I know he was mugged when he was young, and it's sort of like he's one of those guys who just, you know, after that, he's always, I think, a little scared and fragile because he had this one scary experience.
That was the sickness of the 70s and 80s, though, and it was depicted in every piece of popular culture. Is if you go into a parking garage in the inner city, you will be beaten and raped. That's like everything with Death Wish to RoboCop, like in everything in between.
Absolutely, and he, not coincidentally, was the main screenwriter on RoboCop 2. and yeah, like just, but back in the early days, you could tell that he at least made some attempt to see different points of view, and there was sort of a sense that, you know, even if Batman was a little more violent than he had been in past depictions of him, he still, you know, took the rifle away from the gang member and broke it in half and said, you know, this is a loud, clumsy, stupid thing and we do not need it. In moments like that, I was like, yeah, this is really speaking to me. And I think kind of was important to me in terms of kind of forming, you know, my worldview, as strange as that might sound. And then later he just like went totally off the deep end with this neocon stuff and a lot of really questionable things. And even in something like 300, but definitely in things like Holy Terror.
Yeah, well, 300 is, you know, itself fash.
oh, yeah, absolutely.
Everything about it.
It's definitely got that going on. I still think it's both in comic form and in film form, like, well made. And like, I sort of really appreciate it on a visual level. I think it, even though the value system behind it is pretty fucked, has some redeeming qualities. And you know, I guess we could say this about a lot of things that metalheads tend to like, right?
Yes, of course, of course. I had only heard of Holy Terror in passing. I haven't actually read it myself, but that's from what I was told, it was basically like an anti-Muslim superhero or something like that.
Basically, yeah. And I mean, he had originally wanted to make it about Batman, and I think he just, even with the fact that he guarantees sales because he's such a well-known name, DC Comics felt like he was going too far with it. And I mean, they've let him go pretty far with the character. And like, I mean, the worst thing about sort of the decline of Frank Miller for me is that he just doesn't seem to have a strong sense of storytelling anymore. Like, he used to be one of the best storytellers in the business, and now he just can't seem to string together a coherent narrative or make it make sense visually. And I'm sure there's lots of reasons behind that beyond his sort of political leanings, but when tied into the odious political leanings, it makes it so that it's very hard to get through any of his work that he's done in the past almost 20 years now.
I really enjoyed his Sin City comics when I was a kid. I thought those were great. I loved the Sin City movie when it came out. I saw it like the opening weekend. And then, you know, however long, a decade later, I saw the sequel in the theater. And I was like, oh my God, this is actually atrocious. I wonder if the first one was just as like clumsy and awkward and actually shitty. And I don't want to go back and watch it to verify that or not. Have you seen it with any recency?
I have not watched it anytime recently, but I definitely had similar feelings. So I think it was actually just that the second film was not as well constructed or written. He created a new story for that movie that kind of stretched out the Nancy element. Pretty much, I think, so that they could have Jessica Alba in a key role. And, Frank Miller's not very good at writing women. So trying to make that happen, I think, didn't work out so well.
His Ava Green character was written just to be, like, a naked woman who was also treacherous.
Absolutely. And, I mean, there's a sense in which his personal, failings and short-sightedness tends to fit in well with that kind of noir ethos.
It's a divorced dad outlook on life.
Yeah, I mean, which he probably is at this point. I don't know much about his personal life.
Probably, yeah. Anyway, sorry. I didn't want to get us off track there, but for some reason that's just kind of stuck out in my mind. It's the same thing with 300. I remember seeing that in the theater as well. And then trying, I think, recently to, just because it was on Netflix or something, just trying to watch through it again. The visual style and these movies were, very much constructed to look like they were on the page. It just has not aged well. It's so heavily CGI. It looks a little PS2 cutscene-y.
Yeah, that makes sense. I have not watched the movie in a long time, so I have not had that sort of uncanny valley experience with it. Like, it's still in my mind, still something that looks, sort of fresh and state of the art. But I'm sure, yeah, by now it looks horribly dated. I saw a little bit of that god-awful 1998 Godzilla movie just on a screen in a bar a few months ago. And it just – I mean, obviously it's a terrible movie to begin with. But just looking at it now, I was like, holy crap, that CGI is so awful. And I'm sure at the time it was, very nice and expensive. It's just – I mean, that's the problem with relying on the CGI. It's always going to get better. And then whatever you made 10 years ago is going to look so horrible by comparison.
That's fair. Most recently, I really enjoyed the movie Annihilation. I went and saw that at the theater twice, and I kept thinking to myself, like, is this going to look like shit in a couple of years as well? And it's like, probably.
Yeah, I saw that as well, and I also liked it a lot. I feel like probably – like, the shimmer itself, I think, was done in a way that could probably be fairly timeless. The creatures, you know, like I was just saying, like over time, yeah, things are going to continue to evolve, and yeah, those will probably look kind of crappy in a few years. But you know, maybe we've reached a point where it's close enough that it won't be embarrassing. Who knows?
No idea, man. Jordan, have you seen that one yet?
No, I haven't seen it yet. I'm a little lukewarm on Natalie Portman, so I haven't felt the need to go see it.
I thought she acquitted herself pretty well in this one.
As compared to the Star Wars movies?
Yeah, yeah.
That's not fair. I mean,
she tried her best.
No one comes off well in those films. Those are just really badly made films.
I will say that, what is the fella's name? Oscar Isaac, is that the guy?
Yeah,
yeah. He could have been replaced by literally anybody. He did not need to be in this movie.
a piece of wood with an angry face.
Pretty much, yeah.
I think he's a great actor, but yeah, it was definitely a case where Alex Garland, I think, just liked working with the guy from working with him on Ex Machina and decided he wanted him back. But it was, I think, kind of cool and refreshing how decentered any male character was from that movie. It was kind of neat to have it so completely driven by the women.
Oh yeah, because I think he might have been like the only dude with the speaking, aside from the main Asian scientist guy. Those were like the only two dudes with speaking roles.
Right, I'm pretty sure that's correct.
The Silent Hill movie did the same thing, pretty much.
Yeah, I that one's on Netflix as well. I keep watching it over and over and over again. It's not a great movie, but I keep watching it. sorry, I wanted to get back to your record a little bit, because the cover art on it is really striking. Who is the artist that did this one?
That's my dear friend, M.G. Miller. I guess he's going by artistically these days. He did lots of album art for Bong Ripper, so people tend to know his work from that. He's also worked with some people like Lord Mantis. I know him from when I went to school at Northern Illinois University in DeKalb, Illinois, which, you know, just had this kind of crazily verdant metal and hardcore scene during the time I was there. Mr. Miller himself is you know, a very good musician, but there were lots of people there who went on to do interesting things. Bong Ripper, I lived on the same dorm floor with their bass player and drummer. Weekend Nachos.
I was going to say, how far is DeKalb from Chicago? Because I remember distinctly, like, their merch had, like, DeKalb written on it, and don't know anything about it.
Yeah, it's about maybe an hour and a half, depending. You know, getting out of Chicago is always a pain. I remember when Weekend Nachos first formed, and actually Ron, who's in Bong Ripper, was their original bass player, and Adam, who plays drums in a band called Sick Tired, was their original drummer, and I knew both those guys. Just sort of crazily productive scene at the time. The guitar player from Lord Mantis also lived in town at the time. Blake Judd, before he completely lost his shit, was living there. And we just had really great DIY spaces. Dean, who is in the band Disrotted, he was also living there, and he hosted shows at his house, and that was actually how I sort of first got involved in the scene, was just going there and meeting people. So it was just, there was so much happening, and it was a really exciting time. M.G. Miller was one of the people who was heavily involved in that. He would do like these sort of comic style flyers that were amazing. When I saw those, I was like, I need to get to know this guy, and I need to convince him somehow to draw a comic book in collaboration with me for free, because I have no money. that kind of got off the ground a couple times. It never quite worked out, but I have hired him on a few occasions now to do some artwork. He's just he's got a crazy imagination. He's you know, really inspired by a lot of the underground comics guys of like the 60s and 70s, and I think that really informs his style in a way that you don't see as much in a lot of either comics these days or in album art. I think it gives it sort of a distinctive look, and he's, at least for me, pretty easy to work with. Like, we can kind of battle around ideas, and we have a lot of similar reference points. So in this case, I just sort of expressed to him that what I wanted was an image that was kind of eerie, sort of foreboding, and kind of got across this idea that, you know, the lunatics have taken over the asylum, you know, we're sort of poised on the edge of, you know, possible utter destruction, and just sort of get across the feeling that I have just living as an American in, you know, 2018.
What I dig about this is that it's, you know, there's a dark comic style, but it's also, I could see this kind of thing being like an extremely dark children's illustration. If there was a picture book meant to, like, you know, scare children, which I remember I had several when I was a kid. It's very distinctive. I dig it a lot.
Yeah, there's definitely like there's those sort of shadowy figures that, yeah, like a couple of them almost look a little bit friendly to me. Like they could be the monster at the end of the book for sure. That's something that I thought was really cool. He's been experimenting a lot with using charcoal and just sort of working with the sort of, you know, darkness and shadows. I think that that's been sort of a really neat development in his style.
When we asked you to join the show, you posed an idea for us that I thought was pretty cool, in that we because you are a man of letters, some numbers too, I assume, but mostly letters. We would talk about lyrics and have a sort of mini symposium on the highs and lows of lyric writing in metal. Does that sound like something that you're still interested in doing?
Let's do it.
I have brought with me an example of a good and a bad in lyrics in metal. Jordan, did you do the same as well?
I did, and this was so hard for me because I am a lyrics person, and it all depends on, like, what mood you're in at the exact time someone asks you, like, what's your favorite, like, Simpsons quote? It's just like, ooh. I can't do that. It just needs to be, like, in the moment, at that moment, I can give you one answer. 20 minutes later, I can give you something else. But I was able to cobble together a bunch.
What's your favorite Simpsons quote?
I can't. I can't do it. There's just so many.
I'm going to go with purple is a fruit.
It's a good one.
What do you got?
I've always been pretty into ambiguous as a perfectly cromulent word.
Like, yeah, that's a good one.
That's just a perfect line.
Just as an aside, so I says to Mabel, I says is also a perfect understated total side story that it never happened and I wish it did. You got to come up with something, 365.
Beware the Ides of March. No.
who wants to start off? And are we going to start off with a good or with a bad?
I can sort of start us off. I posed the concept, I immediately, I think, like Jordan was just saying, started interrogating my own concepts of what makes a lyric good or not. I think I'm a little more tolerant of different approaches than a lot of people tend to be. I sometimes see people, you know, calling out things that they think are bad, and sometimes I'm like, I can kind of see where the songwriter was coming with that. But then there are some things that are actually just, no question, very bad. So for my example of a particularly good one, the guy who came to mind for me was The Sexiest Man in Metal, our pal Doug. So I went straight to the most recent release from Puron, What Passes for Survival. And I was looking at specifically the last track, Empty Tenement Spirit, which I just think is a beautiful song that, in terms of lyrics, just in the way that it kind of paints this, you know, kind of devastating picture of, you know, emptiness, a failure. It starts off with these lines, it thrusts against the sky, that fallow womb, while the waters we raised lap its lurid weight. Listen, in these austere halls, the generations echo unlived, their laughter muted, their tears unshed. Like, the guy's just got an excellent way with words, and you know, it makes sense that he is also a writer. And you know, something like that sort of really stands on its own. There are a lot of people who I think are perfectly good writers of lyrics as long as you're listening to it with the music. And I was sort of thinking of, as an example of that, something like the Dawn Raid, who I think are great and have a really positive message in their music.
Yeah, they're pretty much the only leftist black metal band that comes to mind for me.
Yeah, and I mean, there may be a couple others, but not necessarily as straight-ahead black metal or as obvious about their politics. But that's a thing for me, is that if you sort of read their lyrics, it tends to be you know, very sort of on the nose with their message, which is really cool as long as you're singing it and sort of chanting that "let the fires burn" as a signal and all that. Like, that's awesome, but it doesn't necessarily really stand on its own, like, as like almost a piece of poetry or anything. So like, that's sort of an interesting thing to me. Like, at what point do you say that something is great as its own piece of writing, and at what point is it just sort of like, oh yeah, that's a cool thing to shout along? You know, someone like Doug, or like Eugene Robinson from Oxbow, I think those guys are just excellent writers. Or Megan from Couch Slut, I think, does some really crazy, like really confrontational, really interesting things with her words. And that to me is sort of taking it to a different level. Anyway, to sort of step away from that, when I was trying to think of something really bad, the name that immediately came to mind was, of course, Five Finger Death Punch.
Yeah, who, that's where my mind went first, too.
Yeah, who just happened to put out a new song, I think just within the past 2 days, entitled Fake. And I'm just going to read you the first verse and the chorus. This is the end. I can't take any more. This is where I'm fucking drawing the line. You talk a great game, trying to make a big name. Soon you're gonna run out of time. I've got news for you. I got nothing to lose. If you were smart, you'd simply run and you'd hide. You're such a dumb punk, such a fucking weak chump. Don't have the ball to look me dead in the eyes. Boom. You're a fake motherfucker. I hate you, motherfucker. I'll break you, motherfucker. You're mine. You're a joke, motherfucker. You gloat, but you're a sucker. Such a fucking waste of my time. You smile and wave with your borrowed fame, but everybody sees through the lies. You're a fake motherfucker. You're dated, motherfucker, and you're never gonna get what is mine. Fake. You're fucking fake. Which
it's constructed it's like a limerick.
Exactly. Like, it sounds like a nursery rhyme or a very basic kind of poetry, which is probably why Five Finger Death Punch are very popular, is because it's got that sort of very basic level of appeal to people. But God, it's so bereft of any kind of thought. It's just these, you know, hackneyed phrases and these, you know, empty threats. And honestly, looking at that kind of made me have a renewed respect for Phil Anselmo, weirdly, just because, you know, he expressed sentiments that were almost as dumb on a regular basis. But, you know, somehow I believe him. Like, he's strangely sincere about it. And his personality comes through in a way that, like, in those lyrics, I just feel like, you know, any idiot could have written those words, and it would have exactly as much meaning and feeling behind it. So, yeah, that's for me. But that's a pretty solid example of what not to do.
I think that's fair. If you are Phil Anselmo, I mean, number one, like, Phil Anselmo and Ivan Moody, I assume Ivan Moody wrote those lyrics, but who knows, you know, both have horrific substance addiction issues, but like you were saying, Phil was able to communicate a little something more in there, whereas Ivan, it's just empty posturing. I will fight you in the parking lot of this B-dubs, you bitch, kind of thing.
Exactly.
Well, he is friends with Phil Labonte, so.
Also, very much, I will fight you in the parking lot of this Chili's after I read the campaign speech from Ron Paul, kind of dude.
I will send you a DM asking for your home address so I can go fight you.
Yeah, I don't know if I ever mentioned that on the show. Phil Labonte sent me a DM asking for my home address. I assume he wanted to come debate the pros and cons of Mises policy. I don't know. But yeah, I'd say
that about that, about Phil Labonte and All That Remains, because I, you know, when they put out that one album in whatever it was, 2004, I think it was This Darkened Heart or whatever, I thought it was a pretty solid album. It had some good riffs, some nice guitar playing, especially for that style, where you know, people would tend to sort of emphasize the breakdowns and whatnot over having any sort of like flashy guitar stuff. And then just the band went way downhill, and he just became unbearable.
Yeah. I don't fuck with any of it, but like that was just never been my shit. You, Jordan, you were into the metalcore at the time too. Was that one that you could get into?
I bought it because I actually opened for All That Remains when they were still a relatively new band.
Huh. Sweet. Man, this all could have been much different. He could have gotten the gig with. Well, any one of the other bands that he's tried and failed to get to join, and you could have been the All That Remains vocalist.
Yeah, maybe people would actually like them.
do you have a lyric that you would like to discuss, Jordan?
Being me, of course, I had to have like 5 or 6 lyrics written down from different bands, just trying to figure out which one I want to use. And going through them, I realized like they're all depressing, which I think, you know, says a lot about me.
It's metal. Like, it is negative sentiments. It's in the artifices and how well you can communicate your turmoil and your hatred and your, you know, just being fed up with the world.
Yeah, I think it's just also what sticks with me more than, you know, fight back, raise up, you know, all that type of stuff. But I'll just run through these real quickly if you'll permit me.
I guess.
Yeah. All right, this is from the band Lillitoo, which had the vocalist from the band who's now in Act of Defiance with a bunch of guys from Megadeth. The song is called Follow Through. The lines are, run forever, run away in spite of all the pain. I doubt myself, and I've given up on almost everything.
Is it, I mean, it's pretty apparent what it communicates.
Yeah. It's just bummer lyrics, and it's always stuck with me. I'll just run through the other ones real quick. Killswitch Engage, My Last Serenade. From sorrow to serenity, the truth is absolution. From sorrow to serenity, it's on your head. This is my last serenade. I feel you as you fall away. This is my last serenade. From yourself, you can't run away.
I will say that album is great. I love that album.
It really is. It set up the whole genre of metalcore, more or less, and we've discussed it on the show in the past.
Yeah, I mean, it created that whole very specific subgenre of metalcore, and also was, in many ways, kind of the last thing that needed to be done with it. Like, after that, everything was, or a lot of it was just kind of pale imitations of that. Jesse Leach's lyrics on it are, I think, you know, really... You just said that you don't like the sort of raw rah-rah kind of lyrics, but a lot of what he does on that is some of the best of that style, in my opinion.
Rise up like, and fight with me, but it's believable, I would say.
Yeah, like at that point, I was all in. Like that must have been, 2002 or three. I remember I was screaming that shit.
All right, some other quick ones. Swallow the Sun, just one night it happened, the morning never came.
That's good.
Zao, Angel Without Wings. When I was crying, you never left my side. When I was dying, you never left my side. You're always there for me. You're my angel without wings. And one more one I really like is Dark Tranquility from the song Uniformity. We must come to terms, admit we are defeated. We must come to terms of bias and deception. Stand up and be counted in uniformity.
Yeah, I love Dark Tranquility as well. And for me, the song Lost to Apathy, that's one that's always resonated with me lyrically, as well as just being, you know, an awesome song with great hooks.
Yeah. Soon the battle is over, lost to apathy.
Yeah, for me, that sums up so much of what I sort of see in the world around me.
And for bad lyrics, I've got Mushroom Head with their song QWERTY. Another motherfucking German Shepherd growling with his teeth stepping, bitch slapping, smack rapping, kick you in the bass drum, boom boom, alpha to Zulu, I'm here to say fuck you, I had a bad day.
That's amazing, actually.
It's all sound and fury, and in the end, it's been a tough one, man.
I'm taking the mulligan, guys.
Yeah,
it's not even original though. It's just such a ripoff of good old Fred Durst.
Yeah, in you know, he had the poetic license to grab a chainsaw and skin your ass raw. And if his day keeps going that way, you know, who knows? Who knows?
And when you were going through the Five Finger Death Punch lyrics, it just automatically popped in my head, Attila. And I just flipped through just the first song that came up looking for lyrics. The song is Middle Fingers Up. All right, motherfucker, listen up. This is for the fucking homies. Stay be given no fucks. If you want to join the party, put your middle fingers up. And when the music fucking hits, you better jump, jump, jump.
Just basically taking things from 30 years ago urban culture.
And saying fuck a lot more.
Yeah.
I mean, 12-year-olds weren't around 30 years ago. So, like, there's a whole generation of people to sell this stuff to. It makes sense. It's cynical and terrible, but it makes sense.
Well, I've never been much of a lyrics person. It's not what when I listen to music, it's generally not what I'm listening for. So I was thinking about bands that I enjoy listening to and then decided to go looking up some of their lyrics, and I was kind of blown away. I was like, oh, this stuff's actually great. And the example that I'd like to bring to the table today is from Migwa, from their latest record, Exercises in Futility. You guys know that band, right?
I love that band and that album. That's a fantastic album, and I agree that it has excellent lyrics.
Just the opening bit from Exercises in Futility 3, the lyrics are, "We hold an honorary degree in natural science for stratigraphy of rock bottom. The layers were plenty, as above, so below, but mostly below. The research is vast, thorough, and firsthand, and it's a broad array of sources for the complete guide to spiritual asshole of the world."
A thing that always, you know, impresses me with, you know, a band like that, and also a couple of the bands that Jordan mentioned, is just, you know, these guys are not coming to English as their first language.
Yeah.
And a lot of the time they do such an amazing job of putting together words. And I'm always like, man, if you ask me to write in any other language, I would be so screwed.
And so this is, you know, not their first language, and yet they're able to do it with just such a disdainful, sarcastic tone and wit that is really unique and delightful. you know, we got Oscar Wilde, a black metal over here. So I encourage anybody that if you like that band, you haven't checked out the lyrics. There's a lot of stuff going on here, and it's really artfully constructed and fantastic. On the other hand, I figured that we'd talk about something near and dear to my heart about bad lyrics, though. Have you guys ever heard of this band called Steel Panther?
Yes,
of course.
Would you like to read some of their lyrics with me?
Do we need to wear protection before you read it? Because I feel like we might catch like an STI through the internet.
Let's do Asian Hooker by Steel Panther.
Wow. Okay.
I'm in Tokyo. I'm looking for a hoe. I tried to score some blow, but I don't speak Japanese. No. Find a geisha girl. I take her for a whirl. Wrap her tuna roll on my dick, and the bitch is on her knees. Sucky fucky, sucky fucky, sucky fucky, smells like sushi. So this is bad lyric writing for a number of reasons. First of all, you know, you don't even have to get into the content of the lyrics themselves to realize that having an A-A-A-A rhyming structure is shitty and awful, and it makes you sound like you have a first grade education. You know, you can rhyme other words. You don't. As a matter of fact, you don't even have to rhyme if you don't want to. putting that aside, everything here, of course, you know, Steel Panther is, it's a winking joke, I guess, but the joke is that, the music and the lyrics and the costumes and everything is actually shit. So I don't know if you can give it a pass based on that.
You know, when they first came out, I thought it was pretty funny, you know, like for two songs or whatever, I was amused. By the whole sort of throwback 80s hair metal thing and the goofy-ass lyrics and everything. But at a certain point, A, the joke just gets tired, and B, just I feel like the kind of humor that they do, I don't know, it's – the world has changed a little bit, and I think people are less and less accepting of some of the sort of juvenile – things that they're putting out, and it, I don't know. It feels like it's a joke whose time has definitely passed.
I guess it's the same thing. Like trying to go back and listen to Andrew Dice Clay stand up. Like people are losing their goddamn minds in the audience. Like watching this guy recite Mother Goose poems.
Hickory dickory dock.
Everyone's like, oh my god, I'm fucking losing my mind. This is the funniest thing I've ever heard. It is so knuckle-dragging. There's no effort to it. There's no real joke. It's just saying something naughty and getting a response out of it.
And didn't he, like, do Madison Square Garden?
Multiple nights. Sold out multiple nights.
Crazy.
So I guess I first heard Steel Panther probably not long after they came out, and I was just like, what is the appeal here? And I still to this day I don't get it. So I think you ought to have to like write a joke if you want to be a joke band. The joke is not I fucking Asian girls. but that's one man's hot take. If listeners, feel free to disagree in the comments or send us an angry email about how we just don't get it.
I feel like there's not a ton of hardcore Steel Panther fans in your audience, but I could be wrong.
Well, no, not in our immediate audience, but sometimes I'll write about a band that is outside of our audience, and their fans will show up and get really mad. I once wrote an aside about how... Five Finger Death Punch, yeah, those guys. They essentially steal valor because none of them have ever served in the military in any capacity. And I received a whole bunch of comments and emails from people that were telling me, "No, I'm pretty sure they did." They did not. I'm telling you, they did not. None of them.
Well, why can't those guys afford decent graphic design? Like, what's with that?
Like, so they ripped off the Deschere's own artwork, right, for their cover art. They can afford decent art. I think it's that they don't want to spend the money on it, They've got various addictions to feed, and they need to take all the proceeds that they can.
And I think people will buy it regardless of what it looks like, apparently.
That is absolutely true, yeah.
I may just be out of touch with the aesthetic preferences of the youth of today.
Well, no, the aesthetic that they're going after in this crowd, I think we mentioned it on another episode, if you go to an amusement park or something, you'll see everyone, the B-Dubs bros of the world are wearing t-shirts with skeletons and soldiers that say badass sayings on them about valor and honor and kicking your ass, and also if you mess with my daughter, I'll murder you.
It's a hyper-aggression and a false sense of like pride and honor and responsibility because they've seen it on TV and that's what they were fed as children.
Yeah, so essentially, Five Finger Death Punch, they've got their finger on the pulse of America, the irregular heartbeat of America, as it were.
The murmur.
So, you know, again, it's not that they're wrong, it's that we are. We're out of step.
That's another great lyric there.
Agreed. The minor threats, they were onto something.
I mean, and all the Fugazi stuff is also, lots of good lyrics in those songs as well.
I will cop to having never really gotten into Fugazi. For some reason, something about the music just never, it was grating to me in a way. Maybe I should go back and retry because it's been a number of years since I have.
You know, I often find that to be kind of a really fulfilling experience when I take something that I originally, you know, for whatever reason, just wasn't in the mood when I checked it out, or just where I was in my life at that point, it wasn't what I needed, and I come back to it years later and realize, holy shit, all those people who told me this was great were right. Sometimes that can be even better than discovering a new band.
I think that we might have to do that. It looks like we're almost out of time on this show, though. What else should we try to get into on this one? Is there anything that you guys would like to do?
I actually have a question for Jason. I actually found out recently, like this week, that we have a direct connection and that the label that's putting out your album, Nefarious Industries, actually put out one of my band's albums a few years ago. How did you hook up with them?
I sent them an email. I became aware of them partially because of your connection when I was doing research and saw that that they had done work with you. But also they have a close connection with a band that we share a practice space with called Mind Collapse. And before that band, I think at least one of the members was also in a band called Arbogast, who also put out a record.
They're a good band.
They were very good. We talked to those guys and they said, the guy runs Nefarious is a solid dude and it would be worth pursuing. And I just sent him some of the demo tracks we had done and he dug them and we sort of moved forward with it. That was, of course, after I had contacted pretty much every label I could think of and most of them told me, sorry, man, I am not doing any more releases because I am not making any money on them, which is sort of a sad comment on the current state of affairs in the music business as a whole, but understandable.
Yeah, at least you got a response. I mean, most of them won't even respond to you, so that's at least something.
Yeah, I mean, there are some people who I got very polite, very complimentary responses from, and I definitely really appreciated that. Those guys took the time to actually listen to music and give some sort of critique or response to it. So I'm very thankful to those people for even spending the time on it. But Nefarious was where we ended up, and I'm really enjoying working with them. It's been a lot of fun and really excited to actually have this album out on May 18th.
May 18th on Nefarious Industries. Go pick it up. I've been Joe Thrashenkill. With me, I've had 365 Days of Horror, and our good buddy Jason. We'll see you next week.
You're listening to 66.6 FM. Radio TOVH. The Flush.